Exploration with Dr. Mishu Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're very proud to bring you an entire hour devoted to an interview with one of the world's leading environmentalists. If you were to write down a short list of some of the movers and shakers in the environmental movement, at the top of the list would be Lester Brown. In fact, many people think that when Al Gore and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change won the Nobel Prize, that the Nobel Prize should also have been given to Lester Brown as well. Well, he has a new book out. It's a disturbing new book. In fact, it's rather frightening. It's called World on the Edge: How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. That's right, he uses the word collapse. In this hour, we're going to talk about something that's very rarely mentioned in the media, and that is social and environmental collapse. Are we that close to the brink? Some people think, well, maybe 2050, 2030, 2020. Some people debate the precise time. What he's saying is that in some sense, it could happen anytime. Something could tip it over. In particular, he points out that any number of factors could trigger this social collapse, including a disruption in the food supply, leading to massive food riots and the collapse of entire governments. So the message is rather frightening, but it's important, and it has to be heard. So once again, we're going to bring on Lester Brown, author of the book World on the Edge: How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. And we should also point out that Lester Brown is the founder of the World Watch Institute, perhaps one of the most important environmental clearinghouses on the planet Earth. He's also the president of the Earth Policy Institute, and he's the winner of the MacArthur Fellowship and the United Nations Environment Prize, and he's been given 25 honorary degrees from different universities around the world. So once again, our special guest is Lester Brown. The book is called World on the Edge. Mr. Brown, you're one of the world's most prominent distinguished environmentalists, but when you were a youth, when you were a child, what was it that set you off on this long journey to save the environment?
Well, though I grew up on a small farm in southern New Jersey, probably some of the things I was reading early on had an influence. I remember I was about 10 years old reading Swiss Family Robinson, for example, which is probably the book that has had more influence than any other. And then later on in high school, reading some of Richard Halliburton's books, The Book of Marvels and things. And he's a forgotten author now, but for my generation, he was very interesting. And then beyond that, after I graduated from Rutgers with an agricultural science degree, I had a chance to spend half a year living in Indian villages under the International Farm Youth Exchange Program. And so that experience and the exposure to population pressure and food issues in India at that time, I think had a long-term effect on my thinking and my career.
Okay, well, now let's talk about something that's rarely talked about, and that is social collapse. What happens when we face a, quote, perfect storm of food shortages and water scarcity and costly oil? John Bennington of the United Kingdom, chief science advisor, talked about a perfect storm by 2030. And then Jonathan Porritt, former chair of the UK Sustainable Development Commission, talked about, well, maybe it could be as close as 2020. So what are your thoughts about something that's very rarely talked about, and that is complete total collapse? When might it happen? What could trigger it?
Well, if I were to pick what I think is the weak link in our global civilization, it would be the food supply. And it took me some time to reach that conclusion, because I had assumed for a long time that for our modern advanced technology civilization, food would not be an issue for us. But I now think not only that food is or could be the weak link, I think it is the weak link, and I think we're now beginning to see that. And to just give you a quick extension of John Beddington and Jonathan Porritt's thinking, John Beddington 2030, Jonathan Porritt 2020, I think it could come at any time. And to illustrate that, I would simply go back to the heat wave in Western Russia this past summer, when the average temperature in Moscow for the month of July was 14 degrees Fahrenheit above the norm. I mean, if someone had mentioned that as a possibility, you know, at this time last year, I would have said, you know, I'm not a climate denier, but 14 degrees is really sort of beyond
the
pale. But that's exactly what happened. Now, it cost the Russians 40% of their grain crop this year. They've been hoping for about 100 million tons, and because of the extreme heat and drought, they ended up with about 60 million tons. But the world was lucky in the sense that if that heat wave had been centered not in Moscow but in Chicago, and if the United States had lost 40% of its 400 million ton grain harvest, we, the U.S. and the world, would have lost 160 million tons of grain. World grain stocks would then have dropped to the lowest level in history, the lowest level on record. And grain prices would have gone far beyond anything we've seen, even those in the last few years. Food prices would have begun climbing around the world. Grain exporting countries would have begun to restrict exports to try to keep their food prices at a manageable level. And then we probably would have seen oil exporting countries begin to try to barter oil for grain in order to ensure that they got the grain they needed. And then the rest of the world, scores of importing countries, many of them lower income ones, would have been scrambling for whatever was left. And we would have seen food riots and demonstrations on a scale we've not seen before, because desperate people do desperate things. We would have seen governments falling left and right. Instead of watching smoke in Moscow and the doubling of the death rate in Moscow from respiratory and heat stresses, we would have been watching on the news reports of falling governments in one country after another. And that would have led to a total loss of confidence in the world grain market as a source of supply. And that's a very dangerous sort of development, because it creates a situation where it's every country for itself and no one worries about the larger picture anymore.
Wow. Well, that's quite a scenario. So you're saying that something like food riots or food shortages could be the tipping point and trigger a possible social collapse, and that could happen unpredictably any time, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. What we have to remember is that we live in an integrated world economy, one where a housing bubble bursting in one country, like the United States, can send shockwaves throughout the world economy and actually put it on the international financial system on the verge of collapse. I mean, it took a concerted international effort to avoid that. And that was just a housing bubble in one country. But what we're looking at now is food bubbles in a number of countries. And these food bubbles are being created by overpumping aquifers and by overplowing land that's eroding and the soil's blowing away, and these dust bowls forming in northern China and in Central Africa, for example. So things can go pretty fast, and I don't think we realize how close to the edge we are.
Now, some people say that the key to the grain harvest is good weather. And of course, with global warming, the weather becomes more unpredictable with swings in the weather, but also water. Now, you mentioned water tables. So what does it mean if we have falling water tables? What does that mean for food harvests?
Well, we have identified 18 countries where water tables are falling as a result of overpumping for irrigation. Those 18 countries contain over half the world's people, and they include the big three grain producers, China, India, and the United States. Now, some of these bubbles are based on use of fossil water. The water for irrigation is being pumped from fossil aquifers. A fossil aquifer is an aquifer that does not recharge. Most of the world's aquifers are replenishable aquifers, and they recharge from rainfall. But one of the most dramatic bursting bubbles has been in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have been self-sufficient in wheat production for more than 20 years. And then just a couple years ago, they announced that their aquifer that they'd been pumping from, which is a fossil aquifer, was largely depleted, and they're going to phase out wheat production over the next 8 years. In fact, their wheat harvest has shrunk by 70% here in just 2 or 3 years, and in another year or so, they will be out of the wheat production business altogether. So this is a particularly dramatic bubble bursting for two reasons. One, in Saudi Arabia, if you don't have irrigation water, you probably do not have agriculture. And they were totally dependent on a single fossil aquifer. But in terms of size, the big bubbles, the water-based food bubbles, are in India and China. The World Bank data indicate that 175 million people in India are being fed with grain produced with overpumping, which by definition is a short-term phenomenon. In China, the comparable number we estimate is 130 million Chinese being fed with grain produced by overpumping. And when you begin putting these numbers together and you realize that sooner or later these bubbles are going to burst, then you realize that expanding the world grain harvest is not going to be as easy as it was up until recently. We see in the Arab Middle East, for example, not only Saudi Arabia, but also we see declining grain harvest in Syria and in Iraq, and we see in Yemen a coming massive reduction in irrigation because they're pumping their aquifers dry. And this is the first geographic region, the Arab Middle East, the more populous countries being Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. This is the first region where we're seeing an actual decline in grain production because of water shortages.
And some people think there could be water wars and that water could be just as precious as oil in some areas. What are your thoughts?
The idea that there will be could be water wars is one that's been around for some time. Up until now, the competition for water has actually taken place in the world grain market. And the reason for that is that if you have a huge water deficit, the easiest way to import water is in the form of grain. So when you import 1 ton of grain, you're actually importing 1,000 tons of water. So up until now, the competition for water has been in the world grain market. To the extent there is a world water market, it is the grain market. This is how countries with water surpluses export their water in the form of grain, and countries with water deficits import water in the form of grain.
Now, also in your book, you mention eroding soils and expanding deserts. Here in the Northeast and also in the Midwest, people complained about snowstorms. But isn't it true that in other parts of the world, like in China, they have droughts? So what about eroding soils and expanding deserts?
Droughts certainly contribute to especially the wind erosion and the dust storms that we see, the dust bowls that we see forming now in northern and western China and western Mongolia. I mean, every year about this time in the early February or so, the dust storms start coming out of that region and moving eastward, and they blanket cities like Beijing with dust. I mean, there are days at this time of the year when you have to drive with your lights on during the daytime because there's so much dust in the air and visibility is so reduced. And this dust goes all the way to Korea and Japan, and occasionally some of it, in one of those dust storms will remain intact all the way across the Pacific, and we'll see dust fall in the western United States, for example. But every one of those dust storms, and there are a number of them each year, carries away millions of tons of topsoil. So in northwestern China, we've seen, I think it's 23,000 villages either totally abandoned or partly depopulated because farmers are losing cropland as the sand dunes begin encroaching on their land. And this dust bowl in northern China and western Mongolia is being caused by a combination of overplowing and overgrazing. But it's getting bigger every year. And the Chinese have not been able to stop the expansion of their deserts. And then we have Central Africa with a huge dust bowl developing, centered more around Chad than any other country, but with wind picking up dust in all the Sahelian zone countries as part of that huge dust bowl.
Now, let's talk also about the big one, and that is rising temperatures, climate change, melting ice. Some people say that because we have the snowstorm, there is no such thing as global warming. But what are your thoughts?
Well, the most visible answer to that question about the snowstorms and so forth is to look at the jet stream and its behavior in the Western Hemisphere in both in recent days, but over the last couple of years, because the jet stream, which is normally a fairly clearly defined circle of air moving eastward in the northern hemisphere and across the temperate zone countries, has actually at some points in the last few weeks has broken up entirely. And some parts of it are flowing north, some are flowing south, and it is doing two things. It is pulling cold air down in some parts of the area. So we have snowstorms in Arkansas and Texas and Georgia, and at the same time in northern Canada and Greenland we have unusually mild temperatures because warm air is being pulled up. So it's if you look at this, and there's actually a video of several minutes, it compresses some days of the jet stream into an easily viewed period, and it's unbelievable to see how it comes apart in the Western Hemisphere, and that apparently is because of unusually high water temperatures in the Eastern Pacific that lead to this breakup, but it leads to a very chaotic situation.
And melting ice, does that mean we're going to see some of our great cities gradually go underwater?
Let me come back to the climate question. Mm-hmm. I was just talking about the jet stream in particular, but the basic point with climate change is that agriculture as it exists in the world today has evolved during an 11,000 year period of rather remarkable climate stability. I mean, there have been a few blips here and there in temperature, but basically climate has changed very little during this period. Now, as climate begins to change, then agriculture will increasingly be out of sync with the evolving climate system. I remember back in the last half of the last century when I spent some time in the Department of Agriculture, and we would see weather events that would tighten food supplies, for example, a monsoon failure in India or a drought in Russia or a heat wave in the U.S. Midwest. And we did, one of the things we did then was simply to return idle cropland. We would calculate how much idle cropland we needed to bring back into production to reestablish a balance in world grain supply and demand. So these were very temporary sorts of grain price surges. The other thing is that back then we knew that weather would go back to normal. But today there is no norm to go back to because the Earth's climate is now in a constant state of flux and change, and much of which we can't easily predict. So this growing mismatch between the climate system and the agricultural system is going to be costly to us.
And as the weather starts to get warmer, what is the threat of melting ice?
There are two sort of major threats here. One is melting ice sheets like the Greenland ice sheet or the West Antarctic ice sheet. And what we're seeing now, and this is particularly clear with Greenland, is that the ice is melting. Two, it is melting at an accelerating rate. It seems like every time we measured, it's melting faster than it was before. And if the Greenland ice sheet were to melt entirely, it would raise sea level 23 feet or 7 meters. But even a 3-foot rise in sea level, and incidentally, the more recent projections show sea level rising by up to 6 feet during the century, but even a 3-foot rise in sea level would inundate half the rice land in Bangladesh. The World Bank has a very good map showing that. A 3-foot rise in sea level would inundate a good part of the Mekong Delta, which produces half the rice in Vietnam, which is the world's number 2 rice exporter. And there are, I think, another 19 or so rice-growing river deltas in Asia, which would be affected by just a 3-foot rise in sea level. Now, what's so interesting about this, Michio, is that the idea that ice melting on a large island in the far North Atlantic can shrink the rice harvest in Asia, where half the world's people live, is not obviously intuitive. I mean, when you think about it, you know, it becomes very clear. But most people don't have the time and luxury to think about all these interrelationships and what they translate into. The other form of ice melting, of course, is mountain glaciers. And this is also of overwhelming importance in Asia, because it is the ice melt from the glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau that sustains the flow of the major rivers in Asia during the dry season. This includes the Indus, the Ganges, the Mekong, the Yangtze, the Yellow River, and so forth. And so this ice melt during the dry season sustains not only the flow of those rivers, but the irrigation systems dependent on those rivers. So we're looking here at a potentially huge disruption in both rice and wheat production in countries like India and China. And one of the examples I use for China is that if for this and other reasons China comes into the world market for large quantities of grain, as it is probably about to do, it will come to the United States because we are far and away the world's largest grain exporter. For American consumers, this is a nightmare scenario because what we're looking at is American consumers competing with 1.4 billion Chinese consumers with rapidly rising incomes for our grain harvest, thus driving up our food prices. Now, historically, when faced with a situation like this, as we were in the mid-70s, we restricted exports. We actually banned exports of soybeans to Japan because our soybean prices were rising so fast. The problem today is that China is our banker, and therefore it's going to be very difficult for us to say to the Chinese, you know, get lost, or no, we're going to restrict the amount of grain you can import. Every month, when the Treasury Department holds its auctions of Treasury securities to cover our fiscal deficit, China's been one of the biggest buyers there. They now hold $900 billion of U.S. Treasury securities. So, like it or not, you and I and 310 million other Americans are going to be sharing our grain harvest with the Chinese within the next few years.
Okay, now let's talk about the consequences. We talked about the foundational structural problems that could set off a nightmare of a social collapse. And now let's talk about the consequences of all this. First of all, environmental refugees. We're accustomed to seeing pictures of refugees fleeing wars and famines. Here you're talking about environmental refugees. Could you elaborate?
Environmental refugees include include refugees that are caused or displaced by a number of environmental trends. One is simply expanding deserts. I mentioned the 23,000 villages in northwestern China that have either been totally abandoned or partly abandoned because the farmers are losing their cropland to the sand dunes. So that's one thing. Another thing is the loss of water supply. When aquifers are depleted in some areas, then people are forced to move elsewhere to wherever they can find water. So we have expanding deserts, we have falling water tables, and we have ice melting, all contributing to refugees, to a flow of environmental refugees in the future that could number in the hundreds of millions. I mean, we could see people being forced to move around the planet, many of them across national boundaries, on a scale that we've not even imagined before.
Well, that concludes the first part of our interview with Lester Brown, author of a disturbing new book called World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Once again, for a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Well, now let's continue with exploration as we continue the interview with Lester Brown talking about a tipping point for social and world collapse. Once again, this is Exploration. This is Dr. Michio Kaku introducing the second half of Exploration.
In the first half, we began a rather disturbing interview with Lester Brown, one of the most prominent environmentalists on the planet Earth, with a new book called World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. Now, the words social and economic collapse, we don't use those words very often. But here is one of the world's leading environmentalists saying that, yes, indeed, environmental collapse could happen anytime, triggered by any number of events. So it's a very important book, but it's a very disturbing book because it talks about our future, especially our future if we don't do anything about it. But one thing about Lester Brown is, after painting a rather bleak picture, he also gives us a positive program about what to do. Now, Mr. Brown, where we last left off, we were talking about global climate change. What happens when climate change causes sea levels to rise? What's going to be the impact of that?
For example, rising sea level. Many of the world's largest cities are basically coastal cities, not that far above sea level. Shanghai, New York, London, Cairo, Washington, D.C., Miami. I mean, there are scores of countries that are just very close to sea level. And what that would translate into in a country like the United States, if we had a rise in sea level, just even a few feet, we would see the emergence of two real estate markets. One would be the coastal real estate market that would include a good part of Florida, parts of the East Coast, southern New Jersey, New York City, the Cape Cod area of Massachusetts, for example. We would see real estate prices in these markets falling. At the same time, we'd see real estate prices in the rest of the country rising as people retreated from rising seas and had to look for new housing elsewhere. And again, it's not something we normally think about, but it's something that could be affecting real estate markets, in the not too distant future as it becomes clear that sea level is rising and is going to be rising at an accelerating rate. I mean, it's interesting now that various planning bodies in places like California, New York, in the state of Florida, southern Louisiana, the Netherlands, in Europe, the UK, the planning bodies here who are working on things in coastal regions are actually making certain assumptions about what they think sea level rise will be and integrating those into their planning, whether it's residential, industrial development, or transport systems, or whatever. We're looking at a world with stresses that we've never had to face since civilization first emerged 6,000 years ago.
And do you foresee a time when we're going to have dikes around Manhattan and levees and different kinds of mechanical devices to save our cities from going underwater?
Well, we either have to think of doing that, which can be very costly. I think in the Netherlands, the efforts to maintain their dikes and everything, and they have a very sophisticated, complex system. I think the budget for that is comparable to their defense budget. I mean, it is a defense budget in a sense, but it's a very substantial expenditure. And while New York might be able to afford to build some of those dikes around the city, there are many places in the world that cannot afford to do that. I think of Bangladesh. And one reason that India has built a wall between India and Bangladesh is to anticipate and prevent that potential movement in one of the countries that's among the most vulnerable to rising sea level.
Now, the Global Business Network, an organization that we interviewed on Exploration, was commissioned by the Pentagon several years ago to look at a worst-case scenario when nuclear weapons might be used to prevent environmental refugees from overwhelming borders. And that report singled out the border between Bangladesh and its neighboring countries when hundreds of millions of people could be pouring over the border, and nations overwhelmed by this may use nuclear weapons. That's pretty drastic, right?
It is. What is difficult for us now to sort of evaluate is how desperate people and desperate governments will behave when stresses begin to reach an unmanageable level. And I mean, we don't know because we haven't been here before. We've not had environmental trends before like expanding deserts and falling water tables and rising sea level to drive the flow of refugees on the scale that we're now looking at.
Okay. Also, in your book, you talk about failing states. These are things that we never really talked about a generation ago during the Cold War. But now more and more we're encountering failed states. And is the situation going to get worse?
Well, as I point out in World on the Edge, perhaps the most basic indicator that will tell us more about our future than any other is what happens to the number of failing states. And if we look back over the last 5 or 6 years now, we see that each year the number of failing states is increasing. And it raises a disturbing question, which is, how many failing states before we have a failing global civilization? And the answer is, we don't know. We haven't been here before. Even the concept of failing states has entered our vocabulary only, a decade or so ago. It's a new idea, because throughout most of my working career, beginning back in the 50s, we were looking at a world where we were building new nation states. The whole decolonization period was characterized by a great increase in the number of states. And then more recently, the breakup of the Soviet Union created a number of independent states. So this is a difficult thing for us to deal with. I mean, if you were to sort of step back and sort of think about the failure of a global civilization, the first thing you would look for would be the failure of individual nation states. And when they begin to fail, they create all sorts of problems for the world. I mean, Haiti has become an ecological basket case, now heavily dependent on the World Food Program, Lifeline, and aid programs to sustain it as a country. Even the UN peacekeeping force there has taken the place or helps the local police to maintain stability and at least some degree of personal security. Then we have a country like Pakistan, which is the most populous failing state, but it's also a failing state with nuclear weapons, and that becomes a very high-risk situation. Then we have countries like Somalia. Well, I shouldn't say countries. Somalia is a place on the map, but it's not a country in any meaningful sense of the word, with people trying to make a living by piracy and creating headaches for many countries around the world who either depend on imported oil coming out of the Persian Gulf through the Indian Ocean or through the Suez Canal. Much of the world's traffic goes through that region where the Somali pirates operate. And the amazing thing is there are 17 countries now with naval units in that region to deal with the problem of piracy. But it keeps getting worse and worse. I mean, I was reading an article in The Economist a year ago, and it was summing up 2009 and the earnings of the pirates and so forth. It was almost like a corporate business report. pointing out how many ships they'd taken, what the average return per ship was, and what the total earnings were, and that sort of thing. And it's the kind of problem that's very difficult to deal with. And so we're not dealing with it effectively. We're trying, but we haven't had much success.
And when we have a failing state, we also have a failing economy, right?
No question. And in the case of Somalia or Haiti, you have a lot of hungry people. You have countries that are dependent on the UN World Food Program for the food lifeline. I mean, it really does help sustain them. They can't feed themselves. And we're seeing there's some 35 countries now that are getting food aid from the UN World Food Program. Roughly half of those countries are on a more or less permanent food lifeline.
And I guess the world didn't really pay attention to these failed states until they became hotbeds of piracy and terrorism, right?
Yeah. Piracy, terrorism, and drugs. Afghanistan is now the world's, you know, totally dominates the world heroin market, for example. So we have some real challenges now in dealing with this. I mentioned that the number of failing states is a key indicator. The three indicators that I look at are, to give us a sense of where the world is headed and what our future will be like. The first one is grain prices. That's an economic indicator. And as the price of grain goes up, things get more and more dicey in the world. The second indicator is the number of hungry people in the world. That number was declining during the closing decades of the last century, but then at the turn of the century, it turned up, and it had gotten down to about 825 million. It's now up around a billion, and looks like it's going to continue climbing. And the third indicator is the political indicator, which is the number of failing states in the world. So it's grain prices, the number of hungry people, and failing states, I think, are three of the key indicators that will tell us where we're headed in the future.
Okay. Now, we've talked about the deteriorating foundation of the world ecology and economy. We talked about some of the political consequences. And now let's talk about Plan B. That is, what are we going to do about it, given that Plan A means to do nothing? Now, one part of Plan B is an energy-efficient global economy. So how do we enforce energy efficiency?
I think we let the market do it, but we have to get the market to tell the truth. And we need to both create a more efficient energy economy, much more efficient, and we have great technologies now for doing that. We also need to restructure it in terms of the sources of energy, that is, replacing coal and oil and natural gas with wind and solar and geothermal. And the most efficient way to do that is simply to restructure the tax system, that is, lower income taxes, and offset that with a rise in the carbon tax. And this would, if we were to do this over a period of, say, 10 years, and we wouldn't pay any more taxes, we'd pay exactly the same. We would just tax labor less and carbon more. That would lead to a very rapid shift from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy.
Now, some people say that when you buy something, it doesn't really reflect the true cost of it because you have waste disposal and you have the impact on the environment and any number of lawsuits arising from it. And so some people say that a carbon tax would actually make objects reflect the true cost. What are your thoughts?
That's precisely the reason for restructuring the tax system is because the market economy, which a century ago was fairly honest, and it reflected prices reflected real cost. But today, with fossil fuels, for example, in the United States, we pay say $3 for a gallon of gasoline. But that includes the cost of pumping and getting the oil to a refinery and making the gasoline and getting that to the local service station. It does not include the costs of climate change. It doesn't include the cost of treating respiratory illnesses from breathing polluted air. It doesn't include the cost of the U.S. military establishment in the Middle East to protect access to oil. So when you put all these costs in, the cost of gasoline, it turns out the real price is not $3, it's more than $12. And yet we go around thinking gasoline is cheap. Well, at the pump it is cheap, but in terms of its cost to society, and including the next generation will have to deal with climate change and hundreds of millions of climate refugees and all the things that come with climate change, then we're in real trouble.
Okay, and also for a positive program, you mentioned wind, solar, geothermal. So let's take them one at a time. First of all, wind power, which is growing rapidly in Europe, some people think that eventually it'll hit a ceiling because how many cities can harness wind? But what are your thoughts about the future of wind power?
Wind is an extraordinarily abundant resource, and that's particularly true in the large economies like the United States and China. It's also true in Europe. There's enough wind energy in the North Sea to more than provide all the electricity Europe can consume. In the U.S., we have three states, North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, that can provide far more electricity, indeed could satisfy total energy needs for this country and have a lot left over. The most recent study in China indicates that China could increase its current electricity consumption from wind alone by 16-fold. So China has far more wind than it could ever possibly use to generate electricity. So the idea here is to restructure prices, restructure the market to get it to tell the truth. And if we do that, we'll see enormous growth in wind energy, even beyond the 30% a year or so that we now have.
And wind parks are sprouting up around the world, right? China is going to go heavily into wind, and even in the United States, right?
Oh, yes. We have now over 40,000 megawatts of generating capacity in both the United States and China. But China is growing much faster. They have a program to develop, and this is a government-organized program, to develop 7 wind mega complexes, each of which will have more than 10,000 megawatts of generating capacity, and some of them will be up close to 20 or more. But altogether, when these wind mega complexes are finished, they will generate 130,000. They will have 130,000 megawatts of generating capacity. That's equal to building another coal-fired power plant every week for the next 2.5 years in China. That is to say, it's not trivial. It's really quite large. And this is only this special program. There are hundreds of other wind farms going up in China that are independent of these wind mega complexes. So we're seeing some exciting progress now in various parts of the world, including in China.
Now, what about solar power? People talk about it. People have been talking about it for a long time. Prices are still high, but prices are dropping. What about the future of solar?
There are two forms of solar energy that are being widely harnessed now. One is using solar cells, photovoltaics, that silicon wafers basically convert sunlight directly into electricity. And the second is solar thermal power plants, where a collection of mirrors focuses sunlight on a huge container of water or some liquid and boils it and uses it to run electrical generators. We use the steam in the same way that you would from a coal plant or a gas plant or a nuclear power plant. Those are the two technologies, and we're now seeing for the first time a number. There must be probably a dozen huge wind complexes measured in the hundreds of megawatts, that is comparable to a coal-fired power plant. There's one solar complex developing in California with about 1,000 megawatts. I mean, at full capacity, that's equal to a nuclear power plant, for example. So we have a dozen of these large utility-scale projects underway in the U.S. Southwest and mostly in California and Arizona. And then we have rooftop solar collectors for heating water. That's a form of solar thermal energy. China's the world leader here with probably 40 million homes now with rooftop solar water heaters. That's 120 million people getting their hot water from rooftop solar water heaters. And we have in Europe a huge effort led by a dozen corporations, including Munich Re, Deutsche Bank, Siemens, several others, to develop the solar resources in North Africa and to integrate them into a grid with Europe. So there will be a European North African grid that will harness both simultaneously the wind resources of the North Sea and the solar resources of North Africa to satisfy the electricity needs throughout the area.
And some people are saying that let's put solar parks throughout the desert. You mentioned North Africa, the Sahara. What about the prospects of using large open desert areas to generate solar energy?
Well, one of the great things about deserts is they're ideal for collecting solar energy and converting it into electricity. The Algerians, who are already building solar thermal power plants to generate electricity and are planning to ship to Europe, point out that in their desert, they have enough harnessable solar energy to power the world economy, not the Algerian economy or the European economy, but the world economy. And this is a point that's made frequently in the energy literature when it's noted that the solar energy striking the Earth in 1 hour contains enough energy to run the world economy for 1 year.
And also, what about geothermal power?
Geothermal power is also an extraordinarily abundant source of energy. It is most easily accessible in areas with volcanoes, for example, or areas like the western United States. A country like Iceland is now heating 90% of its homes with geothermal energy. I think all of its electricity now comes either from hydro, from melting ice, or from geothermal power plants. Indonesia, with 130 active volcanoes, could get all of its electricity from geothermal power plants. Japan is another country with, has tens of thousands of hot baths, and those hot baths are the heat comes from geothermal sources. So we know that energy is close to the surface in Japan. The same is true of Turkey, eastern China, the Philippines. So there are many countries that can tap geothermal energy to meet their electricity needs. We see enormous growth in all three renewable sources, wind, solar, and geothermal, in the years immediately ahead.
Now, let me ask you about a big one now, and that is population. Some people say that even if we do have a new green revolution and produce more food and produce more energy, that we're in a rat race with the population. The rate of population growth is slowing down, but in other areas it's still exploding. So what are your thoughts about population and poverty?
Well, the stabilization of population and the eradication of poverty go hand in hand. Once you begin accelerating the shift to smaller families, then poverty begins to disappear. And when you begin to eradicate poverty, you accelerate the shift to smaller families. So we know what works and what we have to do. The exciting thing here is that there are, according to the latest survey, 215 million women in the world who want to limit their family size but do not have access to family planning services. They don't have to be convinced about anything. They know what they want to do. They want to have fewer children, and they want to space them more so they don't have one right after the other, and thus have healthier children. Filling that family planning gap is takes just a very small amount of resources. I mean, an amount so small it would get lost in the rounding of our national military budget, for example. So it's a gap we cannot afford to have continuing, because those 215 million women and their families, assuming they have, say, three children each, represent a billion people, and they actually represent most of the poorest billion people in the world.
And some people say that, well, as you mentioned, that as populations become more prosperous, they have fewer children, puts less burden on the world economy. But other areas are still expanding and still have tremendous amounts of poverty. So what are your thoughts about whether or not you're optimistic or pessimistic about expanding populations and more mouths to feed, and that means more stress on the environment and stress on food supplies?
Someone said recently it's too late to be pessimistic, and I think there may be some merit in that. It's now not a question of whether we're optimistic or pessimistic. It's recognizing what we need to do if we want to turn things around. And one of the things that is at the heart of this is our definition of security. We have inherited a definition of security from the last century that was dominated by two world wars and a Cold War. So when you mention the term national security here in Washington, where I am, or indeed anywhere in the country, people think military. But if you were to sit down with a clean pad in front of you and ask the question, what are the principal threats to our future today? It would be climate change, population growth, falling water tables, rising food prices, an increasing number of failing states. These are the threats to our future now. It's not, there's not some heavily armed superpower, you know, that's threatening to invade us or threaten us in any important way. The threats to our future are climate change, population growth, water shortages, rising food prices, and failing states.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest was Lester Brown. The book, a very disturbing book, is called World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Good day for Exploration. This is Dr. Michio Kaku.